Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is award-winning author Eleanor Sullivan. Eleanor and I will be discussing her second book from the Sigula Village Mystery Series. It is a novel set in 1830s in an Ohio village titled Graven Images. Good morning, Eleanor. How are you?
I'm fine, Johnny. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Welcome back to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back.
Fantastic. I just want to let you know, your novels are fun to read. The first one, Cover Her Body, gave an excellent picture of how society conducted themselves some 200 years ago in America. And now, Graven Images further embellishes that picture with greater details. And obviously, your writing of the dialogues are just stupendous. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. I've been so gratified that people have seen that I'm getting better as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories are, they're enjoying the stories even more.
Fantastic. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. For the sake of our new listeners, please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Sure. I married my high school sweetheart, and 15 years and five children later, he was killed in an accident. But I had been impressed by the nurses who took care of him, and so having to find a profession, I went to nursing school and then quickly realized I wanted to teach nursing, so I went on and got a PhD and taught, and then I moved into administration, and my last position in that was a dean at the University of Kansas. And I had written books all the way through. Certainly professors have to write professional articles.
Mm-hmm.
I still write textbooks for nurses, as a matter of fact. But then I started getting into or wanting to write mysteries. And I wrote a series of three featuring a nurse in contemporary times. Then I moved on to this historical series. And as you said, there are two books in this series. So that's where
Wonderful.
I am right now.
Fantastic. What life experiences led you to writing novels?
I think it was just having, first with nursing.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw a book that got nursing right. TV shows don't get nursing right. Movies don't. And nurses just wring their hands over the inaccuracies. And so that was my inspiration to do the first series of books, because I had learned what nursing really is and how in-depth it is and how it takes the nurse's skill and education, and it makes a difference between life and death for the patient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was my inspiration for that series, but the second series is of interest to me because my ancestors escaped persecution in Germany and came to Ohio, where they settled this town of Zor, and I want to tell their stories.
Fantastic. How has writing actually influenced your life over the years?
Oh, I think it's been, this has been a big surprise to me. I really mine my own memories and my own emotions. They just come out. When I get into a character and I think, or my editor tells me constantly, how would she feel when this happened? And I have to really think about that. And I think it's been a mental health opportunity because I get those things to the forefront and kind of work through them in my writing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the characters I don't like, they can. I have no trouble figuring out how people act. that I don't like and have done things I'm not happy about. So it's an opportunity to sort of get that out, too, and maybe away from me.
I heard a lot of people that write fiction where they write a character that they don't like and they kill him off.
Yes, that's right. We can get rid of those people.
Why write historical mystery novels?
Well, I think it was because of my ancestors coming over here. My grandmother took my sister and I back to this town, and we trooped through the museums, and she told the story of how brave our ancestors were, and later I took my children back there, and it's always just been a special place, I think because they worked so hard to get here to America, and had they not done that, I'd be speaking German today.
Interesting, very, very interesting. How do you come up with the idea of making a good historical mystery novel, though? I'm sure that's kind of a little tough to do that.
The tough part is the actual plot, the story, the murder. The historical aspects, I've had so many fine resources, including the historian there and lots of resources, the Ohio Historical Society, that and the people who are there now and who know, that forms the background, and it's pretty easy to see how someone might choose someone to murder. You know, these people lived 300 people in a small town where they seldom saw too many other outsiders, and you can imagine the jealousies and the anger and the envy and all the problems that would go on. So finding someone to murder, and especially in Graven Images, it's an outsider, which they certainly didn't like. So it's not hard to find a victim and then get started with why he or she was killed and go on from there.
Interesting. Coming back to your ancestors, what makes their lives so special that you wanted to capture them in mysteries?
Last year, I had the opportunity to go with some people from Ohio, from Zur, to back to Germany, and we retraced our ancestors' steps from their hometowns to the prison where they were imprisoned because they refused to follow the Lutheran religion. That was it. They refused to follow the religion, the same religion. And I saw the lake they had to dig, of course, by hand. And because the royals didn't want to see the mess, they had to do it at night. I talked with the two historians who have studied the history of this, we would call it a sect. Some people would call it a cult. But what it was a group of people who believed in the simplicity of belief. Faith, that you didn't need a church, you didn't need symbols or sacraments. Much like the Quakers, the Amish, the Shakers, some of those people. And the bravery that they endured to get to stick with their beliefs and also then to get to America. When I was there in my ancestor's hometown, I met his brother. He left in 1817. His brother and sister stayed. And all down the line, almost every single descendant of that brother and sister stayed in this little tiny town. And their descendants I met when I was there. And so what made him go and the others not? I don't know the answer. And you know, when they came over here, they knew they were leaving behind forever the life they had known, their family. Their country, and to do that, it's just incredibly brave.
And we're not talking about like just a couple hundred miles here. We're talking about, I guess, in this case, like the British would say, across the pond.
Yes.
And that's a long way.
And it was, of course, back then, in 1817, and they had to. They of course had no money. Some Quakers in England helped them, and they rode in steerage. And the ship apparently got lost, and what they suspect is because it took 4 months to get here, and normally that was not the case, even in that day, what they suspect is that it got off course and went to Canada before they were able then to get down to Philadelphia where they embarked. I asked the historian when I was there last month for this book release, if any of them died on the ship, you'd have to think they did. And she said, we suspect some did, but there are no records. You know, if they weren't on the manifest when they pulled into Philadelphia, we don't know.
Right.
But just to do that, I can't imagine how awful that that was.
Me too. And I'm just picturing this out in terms of, like, okay, let's go to the brave new world. But at the same time, like you were saying, there's really no way of going back because in this case, you know, you might risk prosecution going back.
They certainly would, yes, particularly if they went back. You know, Germany was not a country then. It was just a number of different fiefdoms. Mm-hmm. And so possibly if someone had gone back, and maybe someone did, and we just have no record of it.
Right.
I think if they stayed out of their local fiefdom, which was in Württemberg, they might have been all right because, you know, travel wasn't that easy and they probably wouldn't have been tracked down. But had they gone back to their hometown, yes, I think they would have again been incarcerated.
What's interesting about this whole dilemma is that the fact that even though they lived a very simple life, but somehow you guys have excellent record keeping and able to track back in terms of genealogy and ancestries and so forth. So tell us a little bit about that, on how well they kept the records.
Oh, I found that so interesting. When we were there in the town, and incidentally, only one man in town spoke English, but the people there were so thrilled that we were coming, there were 12 of us, that they had this coffee for us and fixed local pastries and so forth. And on the wall, they had taped up the genealogy from the 1600s to today.
Wow.
They had underlined in red each person there, their heritage. And in fact, this man was so kind that he sent me those, he emailed me copies of those genealogy. So they kept excellent records. And then also in this country, of course, the LDS Church has kept all these fine records. And people in my relatives from the past have collected those. And so that I had a lot of material before I even went, but they had more.
Yeah.
Interestingly, you got to remember these people, the rest of these people stayed in Germany, and on two occasions, one in 1918, they put, you know, birth dates and death dates, and it said on this one person, missing in Russia, and another one in 1843, it said, killed in France, and it occurred to me when I saw that these people were fighting for the Germans against them. And, of course, they had no choice.
Yeah.
So it was kind of moving to see that.
Yeah. When it comes to historical accuracy, how much research did you do before you write the novels?
Well, before I start, I try to find some general knowledge. Like in this, Graven Images, I have an itinerant artist. And so I read up on, they were called limners. And I read up on limners in the early 1800s in America, New England and beyond. And then I have Irish travelers coming through, and so I read up some on Irish travelers. But then as I get into the story, I find I want to know more details. And then I don't want to waste a lot of time finding out too much and then not use it or not need it. And so as the story progresses, I see where the scenes are going and where I might need to add a little something in there. And the same thing for all the other aspects of the story. Like there's a tin man, but someone who works with tin. And I interviewed a man who does tin work in the town right now. And took a lot of pictures of what he did, and then, of course, thanked him in the story. So it's sort of a both before and during. And then sometimes really at the end I go back and say, well, I needed a little more here, or I needed a little less. It's easy to sort of throw it all in. And I don't want to do too much of that to bog the story down, but I think readers like to get a glimpse into this world. So that's what I'm for.
Right. Well, what is the inspiration behind Graven Images?
I think I wanted to show that outsiders, that the town, the townspeople were conflicted about how they felt about outsiders. They wanted them to come to town, and they built a hotel, and they built a canal in because they were on the Ohio Canal, and so mm-hmm. they wanted the income from that. That's one of the ways that they prospered. On the other hand, some of them did not want these outsiders and their influence. You know, they came in and
right.
they had money, and they showed the young people what life was like if you could really wear nice clothes and
mm-hmm,
have
mm-hmm.
things and so forth. And then I thought about what if an artist came to town and he started painting pictures of the children, and how would they react to that? And it wasn't good. And so it got me started. That, and also I heard a lecture about Irish travelers and how they were often maligned, unfairly
mm-hmm.
maligned. Although they did, their purpose was to steal. They thought settled folk were meant to steal. And
mm-hmm.
I talked with some people who do history in Irish mm-hmm. travelers, and I have a strong feeling of protecting minorities and people who are disadvantaged, and so giving
yeah.
an opportunity to talk about that. So I think that was the inspiration for that story.
Well, wonderful. Give us a quick synopsis of the book then.
Okay, well, when this artist comes to town, the people are very upset when they see these images that he's painted, because that's strictly verboten in their rules and regulations. And then when he's found murdered, they conveniently accuse the Irish traveler. And Adelaide, the young midwife and herbalist, my main character, she
mm-hmm.
is so afraid that it actually was one of their own, and she knows that the traveler will be sent off and the Ohio authorities will be all too happy to blame him, and he'll be hanged if she can't find who the true murderer was.
Interesting. So how did you come up with the various characters?
I think the inspiration for Adelaide is that I wanted a strong woman. The community and their agreement and their rules, they profess that women and men, everyone is equal. That was the trouble they had with Germany, is that there was no, they didn't believe anyone was higher than others. The duke or the king was not really better than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they came here, they said men and women, everyone is equal. And women had a vote in the town. You know, in 1817, took America 100 years more.
Right.
However, I think over time that those prejudices against women still came through, and it's interesting. They elected trustees. They erected a 5-member standing committee to settle disputes, and never once was a woman elected. And they had about twice as many women as men. So I wanted a character who would stand up to this inequality and would stand up to my ancestor, who pretty much ruled with an iron fist from all accounts, and that she would not let the group will, so to speak, convict someone or make a decision that she didn't agree with without fighting for it. And then her husband, Benjamin, who actually is more worried they're going to be thrown out of the town, which one family was actually, in reality, thrown out of the town for not following the rules. And so he's afraid she's going to cause trouble. They'll get thrown out along with their daughter. And he had a very deprived childhood because of the authorities imprisoning his parents in Germany. So being thrown out was a huge fear of his, and so she comes up against him, and him wanting to take care of her, and kind of rails against that too. So that's kind of how I started with the two main characters, and then of course I had Joseph, who was my distant grandfather, who was their
mm-hmm.
real life leader, and I came across documents and learned more in Germany about him, and he really thought he thought a lot of himself. He thought he knew best, and he ruled accordingly.
Right.
And
right.
So he's a perfect foil for Adelaide. And I like kind of showing that, because when I visit the town, they just really revere him. And I kind of like say, well, yeah, he was also a man. So let's look
right.
at the whole picture.
So you basically pull some of the strength of real people and turn them into various characters in the novel themselves. And then in addition to that, obviously you created their personalities and so forth, and you created some additional characters to go along with it.
Yes, and this was the first time when I started these books that I used anyone real. When I was writing about murders in a hospital, people kept saying to me, which hospital is it? I'm sure I know where it happened. I said, no, it didn't happen in any real hospital. I made that up. But I used no real characters in those books. But in these, I had to include the leader. He would certainly, if there was a murder and he was everywhere, running everything, he would be involved. And then his son was also peripherally, more so in graven images, in it. And he was very, from all accounts, the only task he was ever given was to take care of the chicken coop. So I don't think he followed his father in terms of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a perfect character for the father. You know how everyone always thinks their children are perfect. Joseph thought Peter could do no wrong, and of course Peter did very little. Period. So and then of course I have Joseph's wife and Peter's wife, but they have not had any prominent place in these stories. But beyond that, well, I did use the Justice of the Peace they had. I used his name, but I don't know anything about him, and it was just someone that who handled their legal work in town. So I have to include those people because normally they would be involved. But all the rest are just I did learn something about the matron of the girls' dormitory from historical accounts. And the matrons of both the boys and girls' dormitory were pretty harsh on those children. And in my stories, we see a matron who is very harsh. So some of the, and of course, that's another thing. Adelaide wants to right that wrong. So she has plenty to do, and she'll have plenty to do in more in future stories as well.
Fantastic. Were there challenges in writing the book?
I think the biggest challenge I've had, Johnny, over all of these books is not as much plot, because that I can sort of think that through, and I've read a lot of mysteries. Creating the character isn't that difficult initially, but it's getting into the emotions and how would I feel if I discovered a dead body, or how would I feel if someone I loved was doing something that was getting them in trouble, and just getting into those emotions and allowing myself to go deep enough to experience that, which isn't always pleasant. So I would have said something different in the early books, but I think as I've hopefully grown as a writer, that I'm finding that, and an editor who keeps saying go deeper. which has been good for me in my writing and probably in other ways. So I think that's the challenge that I'm dealing with today.
Interesting. Did you discover anything interesting while doing the research for the book?
Well, last year in Germany, I did. We were fortunate on this tour to have two historians with us. And one day I asked one of them, Hermann, I said, you know, there are two names for Beimler, which is his last name. It's Beimler in German, but they changed it when they came here. I said, there was Joseph, and there's Michael. And, you know, some of the records show one name or the other. He said, oh, no, Michael was his name. That's his real legal name. When he came to America, he changed it to Joseph. And I said, forever, why? And he said because he wanted to sound more biblical. So that gave me another peek into the character of Joseph. And one other thing I found when I was in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife got married in August of 1803. In January of 1804, their daughter was born.
Mm-hmm.
5 months later. His wife came from a well-to-do family.
Mm.
So I conclude that Joseph took a wife. The family didn't have a daughter with an illegitimate child. And Joseph probably got some money because they promptly moved to a larger town and might have started him on his way. I don't know. I'm just putting it together from what I've learned in the historical records.
Well, it seems that we all live life the same way now than we were back then as well. I mean, obviously, they were together prior to the marriage and so forth. And these are the things that are interesting to find out because this is human nature.
Exactly. And I think that's what I've learned doing these stories is that people are the same no matter what century they lived in and what their life circumstances are. And I even question whether they were together before the marriage because after they had a son a year later and she died a few months later, so then he joins this sect and the children are taken away, but he goes back when he's ready to come to America and he gets the son, Peter, but he leaves the daughter in Germany. And she was 14 at the time. Now, why did he do that? Was the daughter not his child? We don't know. We do know she was 27 before she got married, and she married a man in the birth records was known as illegitimate.
Interesting. Very interesting.
The mystery deepens.
Yeah. I mean, he could have done a favor for her to save her family name or her name, you know, out of respect.
Mm-hmm.
And then
right.
again, the fact that he's going to a new world, bringing a 14-year-old girl with him may not be the right thing to do, not knowing what he's going to encounter in the States back then as well.
Well, that's a good point. And he might have had, she might have been in a situation and someone taking care of her. At one point, the grandparents took the children, but then the authorities took them away and put them in the orphanage. I don't know where she was at the time, and no one does, actually. But the other historian told me she would have had a bad reputation because her father was a separatist, and that he says in German to me, that means he was a bad citizen.
So
you carried your family heritage with you. You know, if you had a bad parent, you were not considered very, you had a bad reputation. So probably why she had to marry someone who was illegitimate. They had two bad reputations.
Right. That will help to sort of cleanse her background in some ways and kind of let her go on a different path.
Hopefully. She did not. She lived to be 42, she died without having children. We think one record said she had three children, but I couldn't find it anywhere else. And even the people in Germany have that she has no children. So we know what town she lived in, and I checked the and we know what her husband's name was, and I checked the phone book for that town and for several towns around it, and there was no one by that name. Of course, that doesn't mean there aren't descendants there. It's just because they could be, you know, have married names. But,
right.
But I couldn't find any.
Interesting. What is the difference in your writing of graven images compared to cover her body?
Well, I would like to think that my writing gets better as time goes on. And that's actually what I've been hearing from some of the people in Ohio and from a few other folks, that I've taken my writing to the next level. But in terms of just the story itself, I think you see how Adelaide is growing and changing. She dealt with her her own ill-gotten wishes. She never acted on her attraction to another man, but she dealt with that, and she's grown, as we all do when we deal with life challenges. Benjamin has tried to not be so protective, but he didn't rush in every time and try to rescue Adelaide. And he does learn at the end of Graven Images. He promises her that he realizes she's an adult and she will make her own decisions and he will stand by her. So I hope, as a writer, I've grown, Adelaide has grown, and Benjamin has grown. Joseph has come to recognize somewhat Adelaide's skill and willing to come to her with some questions, but he hasn't gotten very far on that. He pretty much reverts to his, you know, I know best, father knows best mentality, but we'll see. He might learn some things. In fact, he does in the next book. He comes to really appreciate Adelaide, who gets him out of a lot of trouble.
Wonderful. How much of you is in the book?
I don't know that anyone can be a writer without putting themselves in the book. I don't purposely do that, but everything I write comes out of me in some way, or out of some experiences, or out of things I've observed and people I've seen.
Right.
So I'm sure much more of me than I knew.
So do you identify with a specific character?
Certainly I identify with Adelaide. She's, of course, a better person than I am. She's much braver than I am. I would pursue a murderer under any circumstances. And she's especially brave because her community would be very confining and disagreeing with her and being tough on her. They are for being so independent-minded. And I don't have to live in that kind of a world today. So I identify her with her, but she's a better character than I am.
I believe what you have here is that situation dictates how a person reacts, and I'm sure based on the situation back then, and you did this beautifully in terms of the dialogues that you have, the internal and external dialogue. So what happens is that situations draws the best out in someone.
Oh, very interesting observation. I think it can also, would you agree, draw the worst out?
Oh, of course. Definitely.
But we hope for the best.
That's correct. Depending on where your mindset is at, how is that?
Yes, that's right. And you hope that these are challenges, that having met a challenge, that we've learned something from it. And that would carry us forward into new situations.
Right. Coming back to murder, in doing your research and looking back in Zoa back then, were there crimes going on? I mean, you're looking at a small community here. I mean, supposedly life is simple. Everybody has a camaraderie among each other and so forth. Did you find anything that's odd?
Well, other than I don't think they were quite as much camaraderie as we'd like to think. I think that they did have their petty jealousies. In fact, a historian told me that people would often have to move what house they lived in because they would have trouble with the neighbors. And so she said you'd see them walking down the street and they'd have they'd have things on their head and they had bags with them and dragging their possessions and stomping off because they had to move. They moved somewhere. So I think that kind of thing happened. Crimes, the historian tells me, please tell everyone there never was a murder in Zor. And I only reply, I said, I'll be happy to tell them that, but I only reply that you know about.
Yeah, right.
So,
and that's true.
You know, poisonings, you know, can mask a... Could not be natural.
That's true, very true. So the good news is that Keeping Up with the Joneses is alive and well in the 1830s.
That's right. That's right. Even though they tried to say everyone was alike, each family got so many provisions each day. You got so many loaves of bread, and you got so much milk and butter and so forth, depending on the size of your family. And you wore clothes that all looked alike.
Yeah.
And your homes all looked alike, and furniture and everything, but not really, because there really are different people. No matter how much you try to force people into the same mold, that is not human nature.
Right, right. That's true. How have the city and people of Zoa reacted to your novels?
Oh, they are thrilled. When I first went back a few years ago to do for my research trip, although I'd been back there just because I enjoyed going for a few days at a time, and I said, I'm going to write a series of novels that take place here. They were just, "You're going to write about our town? Oh, my God, what can we do to help you?" I mean, there's still about 300 people there. Not of, obviously, they're not the descendants. A few of them are descendants, but mostly not.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's a contemporary town. But they have loved it. And they come out from these events. Every time I have a book, they have a big event for me. They do a lot of promotion. They make a big deal. And the museum store there carries my books. It's been a wonderful experience. And I love going there, and I love seeing them. And they love having me, which
wonderful.
Is very gratifying.
Your novels speak of how people lived 200 years ago, their desires to be free, and yet being governed by man-made rules laced with strict religious belief. What lessons were you trying to convey from your novels?
I think that no matter how many rules you make or how simple you think life is, it isn't. That human nature just erupts. And I think if people try to sort of stuff that down, it comes out in different ways. Let me tell you something I just read, because I'm getting ready to write for these people in Ohio a play to celebrate their 200th anniversary in 2017. And so I got this historical record from the, believe it or not, U.S. Supreme Court. And there was a man and his family who were kicked out of Zoar because they didn't follow the rules and probably were stealing some money. And this man and his family sued Joseph Beimler, and that case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when I talked to the historian about this, she said, you know, there were people who this lifestyle was not meant for. They had too free a spirit. They couldn't be confined, and they should have left. They should have made their own way. And she said, then there were other people who were very glad to have rules made and be told what to do. It relieved them of that responsibility, and especially in that time, surviving on your own, and this was still the wilderness. This was still the Wild West in northeastern Ohio. And to try to survive on your own at that time was very difficult. And so they were reassured. They had food. They had shelter. They had heat, and all they had to do was follow the rules. So I think it's just that people are still different. There are people today who just want to follow the rules and don't bother them with making decisions.
Right.
And there are people who are such free spirits that their lives just move in unexpected ways, and I think we just have to honor the fact that everyone is not alike.
Right. And that's the beauty, I think.
So that's kind of what I feel that I've learned, and that there are no right answers to life or to beliefs or to what engages us and what interests us. There isn't a right answer. It's that everyone can follow their own ideas and their own beliefs.
Well, your novels are rich in traditions. You do speak about the simple life that these individuals lived. However, their challenges as a human being are pretty much the same some 200 years later. I mean, we all go through the same challenges in terms of some of us needs to have structure, and some of us live on the day-to-day from a standpoint of, like you were saying, free spirit. And yet, we can all somehow live together in a common place.
Well, that's what we would hope, and I think that's why we have so many challenges in terms of governance, not just in this country, but really all over the world.
Yeah.
That's the very same thing. There are places where everyone is supposed to believe, is ordered to believe alike and live alike. So it's kind of interesting that we still see that happening today. And maybe that will always be the case in human history anyway.
Right. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading the Sigula Village Mystery Series?
I think I'd like them to know that those people are not so exotic and not so different, but that they really did live with the same hopes and dreams and challenges that we live with. They
right.
didn't just fall in. One time when I was there with the first book, Cover Our Body, one of the people commented in the audience said, you know, I've been leading tours here. And, you know, we go to the carpenter shop and we go to the blacksmith shop and we go to the weaving house. And she says, I never thought about these people as real people having lives and wanting this or not this or being angry at someone. She said, I just never thought about what it was, how the people lived beyond what the work they did and what their homes looked like. So I think that's what I would want people to take away.
Very interesting. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Certainly my website. And on my website, by the way, I have a blog where I write about what I've learned about the 19th century. And people might be interested in following that. Medical care in the 19th century, crime and punishment, 101 ways to poison your enemies. Or to a few of them. But the best
I like
way
that one.
People have really loved that one. Because poisons were pretty easy to get and very hard to detect. It's really an excellent way in the 19th century to kill
people. Yeah.
But my website is eleanorsullivan.com, and it's ELEANORSULLIVAN. And there's, of course, links to buy my books. They're on Amazon is the easiest way. And Cover Her Body is in print, ebook, and as an audiobook. And Graven Images is in print, just came out as an ebook about a week ago, and it will be an audiobook by next month. Of course, any bookstore can order my books if they don't carry them. And I hope people have lots of opportunities to find my books and enjoy them.
Fabulous. It is an interesting read. It captivates you. It really gets you going from page to page. So you did a fabulous job as far as getting someone's attention and keeping it. So that's wonderful.
Oh, thank you very much. That's it. That's what I hoped for.
Coming back to going to Germany last year, how did they receive you in terms of the books that you've written? Or did you tell them that you were writing about the murder mystery and so forth?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was so taken aback before the trip. We knew we had these historians going on with our group.
Yeah.
And they're in Germany. They're official historians in this area. And I write the blog I was telling you about, and I wrote about Joseph Beimler, the leader. And in one post, I said, we don't know much about his early life, but then I went on to tell the story about his coming here. And I get this comment on my blog from this man in Germany, and he said, yes, we do know about his early life because that's my research. And turns out he was one of the two historians. And so he knew about the book. He was already excited about it. The other historian heard about it. And, of course, all these people who went on the trip had copies of the book because they were from that town. Mm-hmm. So the one man in my ancestor's hometown who spoke English was so excited to hear about it. And I ended up, because he had been so helpful, and I mailed him a copy after we got back home. And he said he would try to read it because, you know, it's a foreign language and it, to him. And then since that time, I've been contacted by a publisher in Germany, and they want to do a translation. So
fantastic.
Peter in this little town is anxiously awaiting, as I am, to see the book in German. And so, yes, he knew about it. The other people who didn't speak English, I think they were just more excited because there were relatives from America who came to visit
mm-hmm.
them. So I don't know how many of them knew anything about it, but Peter and the historians did, and they were pleased.
Fantastic. That sounds really good. And congratulations with regards to having your book translated into Germany.
Thank you. I'm excited about it, too. This was completely out of the blue. You know, you never
mm-hmm.
know what's going to happen in the publishing
yeah.
world.
Yeah.
Good and bad.
Wonderful.
Let it happen.
Right. In writing your books, is there a process you do for constructing stories?
Yes, and I've found it's pretty much the same every time. I start with the murder, and
mm-hmm.
I decide who is murdered and why and by whom. Usually I haven't figured out how, but sometimes
mm-hmm.
that's a little iffy. And then I can start to construct the world that would have led up to that murder.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back in time and what happened. Now, of course, that doesn't go in the story. Then the story starts, and it's how each piece of that then is revealed. And how Adelaide pursues it, how she gets involved. It's always a challenge to get an amateur sleuth involved in a story. So she has to have a reason that she would pursue
right.
a murderer, and she does. And then the things she comes up against, the people she comes up against, the circumstances, things are missing, they're not where they should be, people don't answer her or they lie, or she can't find someone or something. And so the challenges she has all the way through. And I pretty much outline the whole story. I know a lot of writers don't, but, you know, I used to do scientific work. And so that changes as I get into the writing, but that's
mm-hmm.
actually how I start. And it gives me sort of a framework to work from. And it's pretty much the same on all of them.
Great layout. Very interesting. So what advice can you offer to aspiring authors?
The thing that I hear most from people who want to be published and want to write is that they think if they've written something, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very hesitant to get their work criticized. I met a young man last week just accidentally at some event, and he said he had written several screenplays. Did I have any advice
mm-hmm.
for him? Well, certainly,
mm-hmm.
I don't know anyone in Hollywood, so not in terms of that. And I said, Who has critiqued your work? He said, well, no one, you know, with sort
mm-hmm.
of a dismissive
mm-hmm.
tone. And I said that I have found, in my experience, that's the most helpful thing. And
mm-hmm.
not to get your work critiqued by your parents or your cousin or your friend, but by knowledgeable people, by either writers or, in my case, I hire a professional editor.
Mm-hmm.
And as time has gone on, that has just been the most help to me. And, you know, it's always hard. It's always, you know, I cringe when I get her review back. But she challenges me to get better and better. And I think that's the best thing a writer can do. We think we've got a good product because we wrote it, and it's in our heart and in our head. And
yeah.
when others read it, it just is not. So you
right.
need help getting there.
Well, what it is also is that we tend to take it personal, and we should in so many ways because it is our labor of love.
Yeah, exactly. I look at writing as a creative process. Publishing is a business.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so we have to think in terms of, you know, what would be marketable and allow people who have been doing this for a living for a long time to know what works And if the editor says something is confusing to her, then I think it will be confusing to other readers.
Right, right.
So it is hard. You sound like you know from experience.
Oh, I mean, the first time when this, are you out of your mind?
but she didn't understand what I meant.
Right.
But that means I didn't write it clear enough.
That's right. But what I did was, no, I'm just kidding. I would have pulled out a flow chart. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah,
I understand
then you
exactly
can understand.
That's right. That's very true. How many books do you have planned for the Singular Village Mystery Series?
Well, at this point, I have three more planned. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. after the next one, which will be number three, I'm going to divert just a little bit and do one that will take place in contemporary times back in Zohr in the 1800s and back in Germany in the early 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
So they is right. That will be, I'm giving myself a really difficult challenge, but there are so many, not just what happened to Joseph's daughter, how did she die,
yeah.
And why was she left there, but the founder of this group of separatists, after being imprisoned, escaped from prison, being on the run, she disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an idea about how she was murdered. So we'll see if I can get a contemporary character or Adelaide, I'm not certain, to find out what happened to Barbara Gruberman was her name. See what
mm-hmm.
happened to her. So it's going to still be a mystery, but it's going to take place in several time periods. But then there will be two more books in this series after that, and
mm-hmm.
who knows? We'll see when we get there. Maybe more.
Wonderful. Wonderful. What is Zohr like today as compared to its description in the book?
It is almost exactly the same. The most interesting thing about Zohr is that different from what other historic towns, you know, like Williamsburg, Virginia, where buildings were torn down and rebuilt as replicas,
mm-hmm.
these buildings are still standing from the early 1800s. And what they've done is they've just kept these buildings in workable shape. And the very first cabin they built, which my ancestor lived in 1817, is still standing, and someone lives in it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I walk the streets of Zohr and I see these cabins and these houses and the blacksmith shop and the cobbler shop and the weaving shop, they are very close to being, of course, now they have electricity and gas and heat and so forth. But they, as far as buildings, they are basically the same.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
I would love to do that. I think about this often. That I've been very fortunate and I've been persistent to do it and to pursue what I'm passionate about in life. Early on, certainly when I had the opportunity I was determined to go to nursing school. My friends told me, you're too old, you have too many children, and you don't have any money. And I
mm-hmm.
just knew I had to be a nurse, and did. When I left my academic job, people said to me, you have a good job, you won't make any money, and you're too old. Well, they were right about not making any money, but that was now 10 years ago. And so I think my recipe for life is live your passion, and don't let the naysayers discourage you. Do what it is right for you. That's my recipe for life, Donnie.
Fantastic. That sounds really, really good, because I think you're definitely right in terms of pursuing your dream and not let anybody sort of sell you short. The only person that can sell you short is yourself, so that's fantastic.
That's exactly right. And from what I know about you, Johnny, you have done the same.
Well, thank you very much for that. Eleanor, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be New York Times bestselling author Carla Negus. Carla and I will be discussing about her latest novel titled The Clan's Cross. This is the third novel in her acclaimed Sharp and Donovan romantic suspense series. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Eleanor, thank you again and have a blessed day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.